We continue with this page on the definition and location of the virtues, looking in part two, under Plato's tripartite soul, at what you might call the correction of this image that one finds in the Christian tradition. Gregory of Nyssa takes this image of the need for control of the epithumia, of the desiring part of the self, and adapts it. He reminds us that it isn't just a question of control or domination. In fact, he points out that it is precisely in this desiring part of the self that we desire good. And he says, not only that, but it's there that we desire God himself. We are, he says, elevated to participation in the good, metousia to agathu, by epithumia, by our longing, by our desiring. So in the Christian tradition, there is a, you might call it, reconsecration and to some extent a reevaluation of the question of how you solve the inner dynamic of keeping these unruly horses under control. If we drop down now to number three, what I've given us here is, and we will be looking at the details of this in much more detail in the next sections of the course, or later in this section of the course, this is the adaptation of this Platonic model using images of virtue and vice that particularly come from Cassian and Evagrius. One finds here a sense which is given in the citations at the top and the bottom of the diagram, the citations from Matthew 4, that one has prefigured in the temptations of Christ the capacity to discover the virtues that are the withstanding of demonic temptation in each of these parts or places of the self. And so Christ's temptations in the wilderness are understood as corresponding, and there are different versions of which temptation corresponds to which part of the self. But the tradition is that in some sense Christ prefigures this struggle which we all undergo. Christ overcomes it, and he provides us with a model of how we can live resisting the invitations to vice that comes from the devil, and instead practice the Christian virtues. Notice that in the logisticon, in the part of the self characterized by nous, by its highest or contemplative capacity, the vices are the most deadly, the most destructive. These are far more dangerous and problematic temptations and vices than one would find in the other parts of the soul, because pride and vainglory and willful ignorance are the sins by which angels fall. These are the kinds of things that trick the highest and the most noble parts of the self into becoming opposed to God. The opposing virtues, or the virtues that are the living out at its best of this part of the self, are classically described as prudence, phronesis, understanding, synesis, wisdom, sophia, and humility. Justice, as we noted above, corresponds to the whole of the soul, and so I've put it in brackets in this higher portion. If you drop down to what I've labeled the patheticon, that is to say the part of the self that is subject to emotion, subject to being most powerfully moved by things outside, these two energies of desire, on the one hand of epithumia, or of strength, of thumos, on the other, are characterized by, in the case of desire, the virtues of abstinence and temperance and of almsgiving, but they can degenerate into the vices of gluttony and lust and avarice. This capacity to reach out in desiring beyond the self can be lived out in a virtuous way, or it can be destructively oriented in the case of the vices. In the case of strength or thumos, the virtues are courage and endurance, and I've also listed zeal and enthusiasm, which contrast with vices of cowardice, anger, a dejection. We'll translate this as gloominess. Not so much depression or sadness in the modern sense, because it isn't understood as something that happens to you, strictly speaking. There's a large degree of cooperation with the kind of sadness or gloominess or dejection that the monastic authors speak about. It's kind of reveling in negativity, as we would say today. And that constitutes a misuse of what ought to be one's capacity for good zeal. And acedia, which we will discuss in more detail, a kind of listlessness that can be either agitated and actively avoiding things that make for holiness, or more depressed and empty and listless. They both represent a failure of enthusiasm, of genuinely giving oneself wholeheartedly to the task of seeking God. This is what you might call the monastic or Christian spiritual adaptation of Plato's model, but I'd like us to note that this represents a model of virtue and vice in which you have a vice opposed to a virtue, which is different from the way this was particularly developed in the philosophical tradition under Aristotle, and the way in which it was later adapted by St. Thomas Aquinas. I wish we had time in this course to spend time on the material in the Summa Theologiae in the area of virtues and vices, because it's a wonderful Christian appropriation of the more, if you will, organic, the more, in some ways, insightful model that one has in Aristotle, which I'd like us to drop down to now in number 4. Here, instead of virtue and vice being a simple antagonism, that there is a virtue we are to strive for, and this is kind of a Christian model of there's an obedience to a law of God that we have to accomplish, and there's one form of disobedience, you don't do it. There's a virtue and a corresponding vice that has to do with a commandment. That is not Aristotle's understanding. For Aristotle, and again, this is something that St. Thomas takes very seriously, for every virtue, there is a corresponding vice of excess and a vice also of deficiency. So virtue, as we will see when we look at the Nicomachean Ethics in more detail, is a midpoint, a mean, a kind of balance. Remember that beautiful image of St. Antony coming forth from the fort, holos isos, completely balanced, as if he was standing at the midpoint between two, as it were, temptations. Antony is balanced. He represents an Aristotelian or a Stoic, a neo-Aristotelian model, which believes that virtue chiefly consists in taking these energies or capacities and discovering the midpoint between excess and deficiency. And here are 3 examples, and there are 14 actually in the section from the Nicomachean Ethics that we'll be looking at, but these 3 examples will give us an idea of what Aristotle means. In regard to fear and confidence, there is a virtue of courage, but this is a virtue that stands midway between a vice of rashness, of dashing in there when it's inappropriate, and cowardice, of not being willing to undertake things that induce fear. So the virtue stands at the midpoint between excess and deficiency. The same thing in the area of pleasure or pain. Temperance for Aristotle is not simply the question of not eating or drinking something that represents a temptation, but instead it is the midpoint between self-indulgence on the one hand and what we might call anesthesia, insensibility, not having any proper and appropriate desire for that which is pleasurable or avoidance of that which is painful. So temperance is a midpoint, a balance. And the same thing he would say in regard to truthfulness. There is a truthfulness which is a balance between, on the one hand, boastfulness, overstatement of that which is true, and false modesty, a kind of almost pretense that something which one believes is true is not, for the sake of being regarded as modest or humble. So for Aristotle, the question of virtue and vice is not simply one virtue and a corresponding opposing vice. It's much more subtle. For every virtue, it's a kind of balance. It's a remaining in the midpoint. It's discovering the real use of an energy or a capacity which can be misused by excess or misused by defect. And that rather more subtle and comprehensive understanding of virtue, although it doesn't disappear entirely, tends to fade a bit and to become more like what we saw above in the adaptation by Evagrius of Plato's model. And I've given it here in a rather more graphic form in number 5, where effectively the virtue and vice are seen as being a kind of a contrasting experience within spiritual warfare. On the one hand, one has the angelic invitation from God to practice these virtues of prudence, temperance, courage, and justice, but we're constantly at war and threatened by the demonic temptation to do the opposite, to remain in willful ignorance, to use our capacity for desire as lust, for not being eager to do that which is difficult, but be cowardly or afraid, or to act unjustly. This is a simplification which, as I mentioned above, perhaps makes sense in light of an emphasis on law and an understanding of virtue and vice as corresponding to obedience or disobedience to the will of God, but it does need to be counterbalanced by, it needs to be rendered more subtle and, if you will, more psychologically realistic, by constantly bearing in mind Aristotle's much broader and much more flexible understanding of virtue and vice.